The Lord's Resistance Army, led by a ruthless and violent leader named Joseph Kony, has been destabilizing Central Africa and terrorizing people living in the Democratic Republic of Congo, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic. The LRA often targets children, abducting them and forcing them to fight as soldiers or using them as sex slaves. Their treatment is brutal and sadistic. A few weeks ago, President Obama sent military advisors to the region to help stop the LRA and to protect the civilian population. We want to begin our conversation today with Ashley Benner. She's a policy analyst at the Enough Project, and that's at the Center for American Progress, and it's a project to end genocide and crimes against humanity. And Ashley Benner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. The Lord's Resistance Army has been around for about 25 years. In fact, began in Uganda. What was the genesis of this group?
Well, the LRA was formed in 1987 by Joseph Kony, a man named Joseph Kony, in northern Uganda. And the LRA professed to be fighting to protect the rights of a local ethnic group in northern Uganda called the Acholi. And they also professed to want to overthrow the president of Uganda, President Museveni. But it actually soon began attacking innocent Acholi civilians, and as you mentioned, including abducting children and adults, forcing them to fight for the LRA. And it has continued to brutalize innocent civilians wherever it operates.
And why is it called the Lord's Resistance Army?
Well, Joseph Kony formed the LRA using sort of a mix of Christianity and mystical, traditional mystical beliefs that were popular in common in northern Uganda. But as I said, I mean, it's really, the LRA is really a group that doesn't live up to those Christian values. It in fact kills, ruthlessly kills, mutilates, and steals from local towns and villages where it operates.
Would it be fair to describe it as a terrorist organization?
Well, in fact, the U.S. government has defined it as a terrorist organization, and I would say it would be fair to do so. I mean, as you mentioned, it's been terrorizing Central Africa for more than 20 years, threatening civilians and regional stability.
And what is the ideology? As you mentioned, it sounds like a cult as well, but what is the ideology? Does anyone know what this group actually wants today?
You know, it's not clear what they actually want. I mean, they've been operating from outside of northern Uganda for more than 5 years. As I said, it professed to want to overthrow the president of Uganda, but it really hasn't in those 5 years made any clear attempts to go back to Uganda and overthrow the president. In fact, it just seems to be an organization that's become used to preying on civilians and using them really to survive, I think.
It does abduct children, and you know, frankly, when you read about this, it is just horrifying. But nonetheless, I think it's important that we talk about it so people know what we are talking about. Why do they target children? And we should say they do target other parts of the civilian population, but why children in particular?
Well, the LRA is a group that initially, as I said, professed to want to protect the rights of the local population, but soon after started abducting children because it realized that it wasn't getting the support base that it really needed. So it targeted children because they were readily available. They were easy to abduct, to brainwash, and force to fight, and you know, they often were very
I mean, they're, are you there?
Yeah, they were very able to, you know, they.
Well, let me fill in the blanks here, if I can. I mean, what we read about are children who, as you say, are abducted, and in many ways brainwashed, but also brutalized, and turned into what appears to be really violent soldiers. And there are pictures of, you know, 8 and 10 year olds with AK-47s. And I'm trying to imagine, I'm trying to get in the head of a child with a gun like that.
Right. In fact, child soldiers are used all over the world. Terrorist groups, rebel groups around the world have exploited children because they're easy to use, brainwash, and almost fraternize, and commanders are able to basically get kids to look up to them and obey them much more easily than they are with adults.
So they don't. I mean, if a child soldier were to escape, and it sounds like they use all sorts of kind of brainwashing techniques to keep them part of the group. If they were to escape, what might happen to them?
Well, the LRA has basically created a situation in which they abduct their fighters. They're not getting volunteers, and they use a climate of fear and brutality in order to keep them fighting for the LRA. So what they would do is, if someone were to escape, is kill them and make an example of them for the rest of the group.
And they also do abduct children and use them as sex slaves.
Absolutely. They abduct women and girls as sex slaves, what they call wives.
They call them wives?
Exactly.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, President Obama sent about 100 U.S. advisors to the region. Is this, and actually this is based on the fact that about a year and a half ago, the Congress approved the sending of these military advisors. What do you hope they do?
Well, this is the deployment of the U.S. military advisors is really an important first step. What we hope that they do is they partner very closely with the regional armies that have been pursuing the LRA for several years to create a more targeted apprehension plan to apprehend Joseph Kony and his top commanders, and to improve U.S. oversight and oversight of the mission planning and execution. And it really, as I mentioned, the deployment of the LRA military advisors is an important first step, but it really does need to be combined with additional support by the U.S. and other countries in order to be successful. So in order to ensure that the advisors can be effective and the LRA finally stopped after almost 25 years, what we need are capable special forces from an African or other country. And the U.S. should provide intelligence support along with the European countries and other countries providing logistical assistance.
And after 25 years, does anyone know why the Kony and his commanders have been able to live among the population?
Yeah, it's really a tragic story of a lack of will on the part of the governments of the countries affected by the LRA, and on the part of the larger international community. And in addition, over several years, the LRA has received substantial support from the Sudanese government in Khartoum, support in the sense of military bases, financial and other military support, ammunition, weapons. In particular, current efforts to end the LRA by the governments in the region, Uganda, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic are just simply not working. And this is due in large part to a lack of capable and committed forces deployed to LRA-affected areas, as well as the necessary intelligence and logistical capabilities. As I mentioned earlier, what the Enough Project is proposing is for capable and committed forces to be deployed and the intelligence and logistical capabilities that are missing to be provided.
Is the goal also to provide more protection for the civilian population?
Absolutely. It's so critical. What we've seen in past military operations against the LRA, there was a military operation in 2002 called Operation Iron Fist, and then one that began in 2008 called Operation Lightning Thunder, was that the LRA would attack civilian populations in retaliation after military operations against them. And we saw hundreds and thousands of victims after these operations. So civilian protection is so critical, and what we need to do is make sure that that civilians are protected from attacks by the LRA, reprisal attacks, but also that the LRA is pursued after attacking civilians in order to free abductees.
And assuming that the leader, Joseph Kony, is captured, what should happen to him?
Well, Joseph Kony has been charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court in The Hague in the Netherlands. This was back in 2005, along with a few of his other top commanders. And Kony and his two top commanders should be brought to justice. This is so important, and it's been voiced. This is a need and desire that's been voiced by the people of northern Uganda in particular. And some of his other top commanders should also be brought to justice. They haven't been charged by the International Criminal Court, but they should be charged in courts in Uganda or in other countries if they're from there. And then, you know, because there are so many children and adults who have been abducted by the LRA, amnesty is really critical in this situation for encouraging current LRA members to leave the group, and for just creating a situation where communities affected by the LRA can rebuild and recover
and by
and
talking
thrive
about,
again.
And by talking about amnesty, you're saying that even if they may have committed atrocities because they were, in a sense, soldiers in this campaign, that they should be allowed to go home?
Yeah, I mean, many of them have been abducted. They've been forced to fight. They've been threatened with their life if they try to escape. So I really do think that amnesty is essential in the case of the LRA.
And we're almost out of time here. Rush Limbaugh talked about the Lord's Resistance Army and seemed to describe it as some kind of a Christian group, and also actually criticized President Obama for sending advisors there. What's your response?
Well, this was, it seemed, before Rush Limbaugh had actually done his research on the LRA. He quickly looked at Wikipedia, at the stated aims of the group, and decided that the LRA was a good group. But he hadn't actually done his research and seen the dire humanitarian and human rights crisis that the LRA has created. But I mean, really, his comments, I think, point to the fact that the LRA is a group that is mostly ignored by the international community. The crisis that they've created is mostly ignored. And that's why the work that Melissa Fitzgerald, who we'll be talking with next, is so critical.
Well, on that note, Ashley Benner, I'm going to say goodbye to you, and I thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. She's a policy analyst at the Enough Project at the Center for American Progress. And yes, she's correct. Melissa Fitzgerald waiting in the wings. We have another guest as well, Fred Bimek, and we'll be talking about how to help these children get their lives back together. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, help celebrate the music and culture of Turkey and France at an Orient Express party featuring belly dancing, gypsy jazz, and a round of can-can dancing from Turkish and French performers, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY.
Newsworks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. Newsworks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at Newsworks.org. Newsworks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY and you.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation, Library, Museum, Center for Scholars, supports WHYY, celebrating the International Year of Chemistry and autumn's arrival this first Friday. Visitors can explore the science behind a classic fall flavor, apple cider, Bill Wenk of Three Springs Fruit Farm will reveal the secrets of his local cider and offer tastings to CHF visitors every 15 minutes after the hour on Friday, November 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. More information online at chemheritage.org/firstfriday.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Melissa Fitzgerald is an actress and co-founded an organization called Voices in Harmony that uses theater to work with at-risk youth in the Los Angeles area. She was also part of a group of actors, activists, and playwrights who went to a camp for displaced people in northern Uganda a few years ago. They worked with young people using drama and storytelling to help them deal with the traumatic events in their lives, including being abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army. A documentary about their work, Staging Hope, will screen today and tomorrow at the Ritz East, part of the Philadelphia Film Festival. And Melissa Fitzgerald joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here with us. And also with us is Fred Bemack. And he's a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at George Mason University, co-founder of Counselors Without Borders. He works closely with the NGO called Invisible Children, helping former child soldiers re-enter society. And Fred Bemack, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. And Melissa, if I can begin with you and even begin with your film, which I watched yesterday. You went to Uganda a couple of years ago. What got you interested in working with these young people?
I think my work in Los Angeles, working with at-risk teens on the mentoring theater program Voices in Harmony, really inspired me to choose Uganda as the place where I wanted to go. I knew I wanted to go volunteer in Africa, and I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to do that through International Medical Corps. And they gave me several options of places to go, and because of the child soldiering issue, I felt drawn to going there to see if there was something I could do. And the first year I went, I just went as a volunteer with International Medical Corps, and that inspired me to want to go back and do what I knew how to do, which was theater. And I talked to my friends in L.A. and said, we're taking Voices in Harmony on the road. We're going to northern Uganda.
And they looked at you.
And said, great, good luck. Cut to them sitting on a plane for 19 hours going to northern Uganda to do this theater program. And I couldn't have done it without them or without my producing partner on the film Staging Hope named Katie Fox.
Well, what would you say is the difference between the kids that you worked with in L.A. and these kids in northern Uganda? I'm sure there are things they share in common. I mean, these are kids that have been through a lot. What's the difference?
I think I was struck, by teenagers being teenagers everywhere, but certainly the situation and the conditions in which they've had to live are entirely different. And so I think their outlook is very different, and how they even come physically to work on our theater program. Our teens, most of them were living in an internally displaced persons camp, and getting to where we were rehearsing, even though it was very close, was a challenge. And their responsibilities, most of them were orphaned and were responsible for their younger siblings. And many of them were former abducted child soldiers who were dealing with the repercussions of that. And I think even casting the plays that we did at the end, we didn't want to have a former abducted child soldier playing a former abducted child soldier in the play because, first of all, we didn't want to re-traumatize. Our first goal was to do no harm. But also, we did not want to show the community this child who they may know was a former abducted child soldier participating in the play, playing one, because there could be repercussions for that child.
Mm. Fred Bemack, let me get you in on the conversation, and there's so many things to talk about, especially related to these children at risk, but I'm interested in your founding of Counselors Without Borders. What's the philosophy, the approach of that group?
Well, I've been very concerned about the lack of psychosocial support for children, as we're talking about in northern Uganda, former child soldiers, children put into sex slavery, abducted for that. And so I started this organization to begin to address from a culturally responsive viewpoint how you attend to some of those issues. Of course, what we do in the West in terms of psychosocial support isn't applicable in northern Uganda or many other places, so we have to adapt. So that's the rationale behind that.
Does that mean even just talking about things, you have to either approach it very differently, or they're just things that cannot be talked about, Fred Bemack?
Absolutely, things can be talked about, but how we enter a culture with a different, with a culturally responsive perspective, both in the United States, outside the United States, but how we attend to cultural differences and nuances, how we attend to indigenous healing practices, how we attend to the priority of family rather than individualism, all those things take place. So Counselors Without Borders was founded to move ahead with those issues.
I'm thinking even watching Melissa's film, and we see, you know, a lot of young people there, and they're being introduced to theater and to drama. There's a kind of uncomfortableness. Melissa, I'm looking at you. And one of the things that you say to them is, you know, use a strong voice. I mean, and you describe yourself as kind of a loud voice person, but,
yes,
but that it's important to speak up. And it took some of these young people a while to do that.
Well, there are a couple things. I think that's always an issue. In Los Angeles is an issue, but it was very important to us, particularly because they were going to be on stage and there was no electricity available to us. So there were going to be no microphones. And in the end, over 1,000 people showed up. So we really wanted our youth to be heard.
Right.
But I think there's another part of it is to tell your story. And you want your story to be heard. And they wanted their stories to be heard. And our job, you know, some people said, oh, you gave them a voice. We didn't give them a voice. They had a voice. We helped give them a platform to share their voice and their stories with their community. And hopefully through our film, they will share their voices and their stories with the world.
Well, and some of what you do is improv, you know, techniques to help sort of break down some of the uncomfortableness. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, how that works?
Well, I think theater is such a community effort, and I've felt that they already have such a sense of community that's incredibly beautiful, and they were so welcoming to us that was an enjoyable part of the process, I think, for all of us. But I also think there's a confidence that comes when you take a chance and take a risk. It's a completely different kind of courage that's required to do a theater exercise than the kind of courage that they've shown in their lives every single day. And they came to it with a willingness to try. I think it did take some time,
yes,
but it always takes time. It takes me time. So I was amazed at their dedication.
Well, and I enjoyed the fact that they could be silly.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
There's a lot of, and that's one of the things I love about our film and I loved about our work, is that there are some really funny things that happened, and they were so open to it, and we had a lot of laughs while we were there, and a lot of warm times and a lot of tears.
Well, Fred, let me turn back to you, and I'm thinking about those child soldiers and the kind of support that they need in order to either move on with their lives or to confront what it is that they had done as a young boy. Can you talk about some of the struggles that these young people have?
Sure, and I think just to piggyback, Melissa, on what you're saying, it's so critical that there's a place to tell the story. So many of the child soldiers or the abductees have never had a place where they can share. It's too much pain for other people to listen to these horrific stories. I've had the opportunity to work all over the world and with many vulnerable children through every continent in the world, actually. And the child soldier stories from northern Uganda have been the most gripping and telling stories, and the pain and the atrocities that they've been forced to engage in. For them to begin to release that through stories that they've had, through sharing with others, through telling someone who's helping and supporting them, it's critical. The atrocities that they've been through, if you think of the worst horror movie you've ever seen and multiply that times 30, you can't even imagine what they've been forced to do, both as sex slaves, both as abducted child soldiers, to participate in the horrors of the Lord's Resistance Army. So a platform to tell their stories, a place to share, a place to engage with others in a healthy way, to change all these things they've learned, these are critical issues for the children.
And it seems to me those issues take time in order to either talk about them or to try to understand them, maybe even to forgive yourself for what you might have done.
They absolutely take time. On the other hand, we have to start somewhere. And that process, and that's one of the concerns I've had about the lack of psychosocial support. We can't just sit down one time and say, okay, good, you've told your story or some of your story, you're fine. We really have to have ongoing support for the children, the abductees, for the families, for the communities. This is a much larger intervention and support system than just one child, one meeting.
And that's Fred Bemack. He's a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at George Mason University, founder of Counselors Without Borders, and he has been working with former child soldiers, and many of those soldiers had lived or are living in northern Uganda. Also with us is Melissa Fitzgerald. You might recognize her from The West Wing. She's an actress, and she's also part of an organization that went to northern Uganda a couple of years ago to work with some of these young people, and a documentary about her work. The work there is called Staging Hope, Acts of Peace in Northern Uganda, and it's here in Philadelphia, part of the Philadelphia Film Festival. In fact, it's going to be at the Ritz East today and tomorrow. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Melissa, there's actually a very funny part of the film where you ask the young people to put together a song that they're going to perform for you, and you and your fellow actors are going to do something for them. And I was curious what you were going to come up with, and you came up with the Hokey Pokey of all things.
Well, I have one question. What if the Hokey Pokey is what it's all about?
Exactly. Well, exactly. Exactly. The kids were just, you know, gales of laughter watching you guys perform the Hokey Pokey.
As we hope they would be.
Was that the idea, though?
No, actually, we had a hard time coming up with something, sincerely. And we wanted to come up with something, because it was very early on in the process, that would be something they could learn how to do in one rehearsal, that we could teach it to them, and that they would feel a sense of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. We also came in as teachers of a theater program, so we wanted them to be able to teach us something and feel their excellence, and for us to look silly, because I think it's important for us to be able to look silly, because it gives permission to everybody to look silly.
And one of the young men says, I dreamed about Hokey Pokey.
I know. I never thought I would hear that, but I was very happy when I did.
The idea was to help these young people, as you both have been talking about, to tell their stories.
Absolutely.
And these are, I would say, as an outsider looking at them, these are serious young people.
Yeah. They seem to me, and seemed when we were there, much older than their years. Yeah. They were teenagers, youth, that is what they're called in northern Uganda. And yet they had had more suffering and more loss and more horrific things happen to them in their lives than most of us will ever experience in our lives. And yet they showed up and signed up for a little theater program with a group of Americans, and they showed up every day, and they worked so hard because they felt that this was an opportunity for them to do something not only for themselves but for others, for their community, because they felt the stories they wanted to tell would educate their community about the issues that they felt were important. And it was really a public service on their part, and I think that gave them strength.
We also see you in this camp or this village talking to some of the parents and grandparents, and you promise one of these women it's going to be really good, and she says something like, well, I'll be the judge of that.
I call her the critic. And unfortunately, we didn't get her on film, but she did enjoy the show.
Okay.
Yes, she did. Everybody did. And I think that was exciting for our youth, too, to experience that.
And Fred, going back to something that you had said earlier about the importance of thinking in terms of community. I mean, we're highly individualistic in this country, but that's not true around the world, and it doesn't seem to be true in this part of Uganda.
Oh, absolutely. And so what we have when we have reentry by a child who's escaped from the Lord's Resistance Army, what we have is a reentry into their entire social network and community. And keeping in mind that that is far more important than me, my life, what I want, what I need, what I would like to have happen. It's about what the community, how one fits into the larger social matrix. So working, I've been working with invisible children in my trips to Uganda, regular trips back and forth, and they have done a phenomenal job in reintegrating the entire family and community, not just the individual. The traditional ways of working with someone is to sit down one-on-one, the Western ways, one-on-one, and talk to them. This is to say, how does the family feel? How does the family reunite? I can give an example of one former child soldier that I was working, that I went to see. Invisible Children always selects the most difficult, traumatized children, and then I help them figure out how to work with them. And one child was who'd experienced just horrible life as an abductee, and forced to commit atrocities that were just beyond our capacity to even to imagine. He was sitting in his hut. I went to his village, sat in his hut, sat with him and his mother and some other relatives, and we sat and talked about things. And for the first time in his life, he shared the experiences that he'd had. He'd been back about 3 or 4 years, never talked with anyone, was holding this inside, having nightmares, walking around the community thinking, I'm not like anyone else, I'm an abnormal person, I'm inhuman. And for him to share that and for the family to provide the support for him was so powerful, rather than just him saying something and have no family network to say, we still love you, we're still with you. Those kinds of things are so important in the larger context of community and family.
I was watching a documentary called Invisible Children. Is that part of your...
Yes.
You're associated with that, and there was a scene of a little boy, I think his name was Jacob, and he's being interviewed, and then he just starts crying.
Yes.
And he just cries. I'm going to cry. He just cries and cries.
Yes.
And cries. Was that helpful, do you think, for him?
It's incredibly healing, because those tears have been so locked up for so long, and one after the other, all day long, when I'm with Invisible Children working, going out to the communities, that's what you get, because we're unlocking the tears so people can start the healing.
Yeah, go ahead, Melissa. We're almost up in a break, but go ahead.
And
I have to say, Melissa and I are here wiping our eyes as we're talking, but go ahead, Melissa.
I feel so fortunate, too, because I am not a therapist. I'm not trained in that arena, but we worked with International Rescue Committee on the ground and International Medical Corps, and International Rescue Committee provided us with child protection officers who were there on the ground with us every single workshop, and we did downloads every night and what worked, what we can improve on for the next day, because we wanted to be responsible in the work that we were doing. And, you know, talking about community as well and being so much more important than the individual, something that was so moving was our youth at the end of the program. We said, so what's next? What do you want to do next? And they said, we want to teach other children who didn't have the opportunity to take this theater program what we learned. Mm. Can you please help us with a curriculum? And we've been working with them ever since on this.
Let's take another very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Melissa Fitzgerald, Fred Bimek, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about how to help children who've been abducted into the Lord's Resistance Army. We'll take a very short break and we'll talk some more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Creffeld School, a small, progressive, independent college preparatory school for grades 7 through 12. Creffeld offers a learner-friendly curriculum, a visual and performing arts program which includes glass blowing, and an education which is hands-on and experiential. Creffeld strives to foster critically engaged citizens in a community of individuals. Located in Chestnut Hill, Creffeld is widely accessible via public transportation and school buses. Monthly open house dates and admission details at creffeld.org. On the next Fresh Air, criminologist David Kennedy talks about his approach to reducing inner-city violence by offering offenders alternatives before resorting to arrest.
We don't want to arrest you. We don't want to lock you up. Take the help. Listen to your community. But this is not a negotiation.
Kennedy has a new memoir. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A public school teacher eats a school lunch for a year and asks, why are we feeding our kids, hot dogs wrapped in pretzels? Also, Gregory Maguire brings the wicked years to a close. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we are talking about how to help children who have been abducted into organizations like the Lord's Resistance Army. Also, how to help children who have been surrounded by war and conflict. Melissa Fitzgerald is an actress and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. In fact, she was in the West Wing. You probably would recognize her from that. She's also part of a group of actors and activists and playwrights that went to a camp for displaced people in northern Uganda a few years ago, using theater to help these young people tell their stories. And a documentary about their work called Staging Hope is going to screen today and tomorrow at the Ritz East here in Philadelphia, part of the Philadelphia Film Festival. And on the telephone is Fred Bemack. He's a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at George Mason University, founder of Counselors Without Borders, working closely with an NGO called Invisible Children, helping former child soldiers re-enter society. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Melissa, going back to you and even going back to this documentary, what we see is your team working with these young people to create small dramas.
Yes.
To tell their story. And I was interested in the stories that they wanted to tell. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, and we were so touched by that too. One of the issues that they felt were most pressing that they wanted to share with their community were HIV/AIDS, because that they feel is such a huge issue and that needs to be tackled, and that there's so much misinformation out there on how you contract it, how you treat it, whether, you know, how to get tested. So they wanted to deal with that in a play, and I think, you know, our playwright worked with them and with us, and I think they came up with a great idea. They did the Truth Lies chorus and dealt with it in a, I think, a unique and entertaining way, because I also think if the play's not good, the message probably won't get heard. I think that a good story artfully told can really move mountains, but it needs to be good.
Well, and it sounded like the chorus was important. We've been talking about the sense of community, but these were individual actors, but there was this chorus of yes and no.
Yeah,
right?
One voice together. And they enjoyed doing that, and we enjoyed working on it with them. And you know, there were some challenges, too, because of the language differences. They performed the plays in their Acholi language, Luo. So we rehearsed them in the work that we did was in English with translators, and then the playwright wrote it in English, and then we had them and translators translate it back into Luo. So we were back and forth a lot, and it was a lot of fun and very challenging.
And were you nervous before the performance?
Always.
Yes.
I was always more nervous for them than I ever am when I do it, and I'm pretty nervous when I do it. So it was very nerve-wracking.
One of the people in this documentary talked about the girls, saying that, and there are a number of girls in this production, that they seem shyer, less confident than the boys, probably less educated. But we see them, a couple of them, really just come to life.
Yeah, that was a magical experience to watch that happen, for them to find their strength and to express it. You know, they already have it, but
yes,
for them to be able to express it was so exciting. And the other plays that they wanted to write besides the HIV/AIDS were about peace building and reconciliation. When a child soldier returns home to his parents after being forced to commit horrific atrocities, including killing his own sister, which is a very common thing, that they will traumatize them and force them to do something horrible at the very beginning, so that then they say, you are stuck with us. You can never go home after what you've done. And so, you know, our children had dealt with these issues. Some of our youth had dealt with these very same issues.
Sure.
And the one play was about that. And are the parents able to accept him home? Is he able to come home? Are they able to forgive? Is he able to forgive himself? And the exploration of that was very beautiful in the play. And the other play is about a rebel army leader coming back to the community, because these rebels are from the community and they must return. And how does the community accept a rebel leader home? And how does the rebel leader come home and live amongst the people that he or she has terrorized?
Fred, if I can go back to you, and I know you work with child soldiers. Are there female child soldiers?
There are female abductees. There are all, yes, there are female child soldiers as well. In my travels in northern Uganda, what I've continually heard is from the adolescent girls, 13, 14, 15, about them being abducted to become wives, what the LRA calls wives of the commanders, some of them in their 50s, and they're just subject to whatever the whims are of the commanders. And I've heard the detailed stories of some of those encounters, how what happens when they arrive in the LRA camp, how the commanders treat them, and the kind of abuse, and the one moment, you're so nice, I'll take care of you. The next moment, for example, with one of the girls who was abducted at 14 and told to be a wife of one of the commanders, she was told, unless you gain weight, I'm killing you in 2 weeks. You're too thin for me. And those are the kinds, that's the tone and the tenor of the life that many of the girls, not even the women, but the girls are living with. It's very frightening, and they're forced to, for example, part of the weight of this child's weight was linked by the commander to, you're thinking too much of your village, and if you don't gain weight, that's why I'll kill you. So it's a complete mind twist about, we're brainwashing you to think only of us and think only of here and think only of me. And many of the girls wind up actually coming back with children, which is another level of issues, to return to a community with an LRA child when they escape. That's quite something as well.
Oh, I can only imagine that. But, Fred, I'm just curious why you think more people don't know more about the Lord's Resistance Army, considering it's been around for a quarter of a century.
In the region in Africa, people know. Everybody knows about it. What's happened, I think, it's just my opinion, and Melissa, you may have a different take or similar take, that we are so ethnocentric and egocentric in the United States that we're looking at our issues and wander into global affairs occasionally. But we really aren't tuned in to some of the atrocities. How could a man like Joseph Kony be in the international court, one of the most wanted people in the world, and yet most of us in the United States never heard of him? That's quite alarming. So I don't think we see or look at global issues in that context. Thank goodness that there has been a commitment to have some advisors go over and start to look at this person. We've been trying to capture Kony for 20, 30 years.
Well, and I don't think we know all the details of that, but I'm wondering if these are special forces. And as I was reading about him, Fred, I was thinking about, you know, Osama bin Laden, who was hiding out in Pakistan. I don't know.
Exactly. And actually, quite interestingly, I've talked to a number of abductees who lived in Kony's section of the LRA in his village. And so I've heard very graphic descriptions from children about Kony who were abducted. And quite remarkably, many of them see him as extremely kind, except when he goes into fits, where he says, kill that person or torture that person or beat that person. Other times he'll say, don't beat that person. Stop it now. Mm. And so he's looked at as a by many of the children I've spoken with, and of course that's not everyone's word, but the people I've run into, as someone who's a savior, who takes care of his family, who's caring and considerate, and sometimes crazy, but oftentimes quite caring. So and also he's believed by the abductees, this was quite remarkable to me, to have powers. They actually, similar to what the rumor is outside of the LRA, And all through northern Uganda, people believe he has powers. He's never been caught. He always knows when to move from one part of the bush to another. The children who've been side by side with him actually believe that as well.
Mm. Melissa, go ahead.
You know, just getting back to what we were talking about the lack of interest in this issue, I didn't know much about it before I went. And that was the inspiration behind making the documentary, actually, was I felt like I was a relatively informed person. And I'd heard of Joseph Kony, I'd heard of the LRA, but I had no sense of the enormity of the issue. And I thought, if I don't know, then most people don't know. And I came back to the United States and started advocating for peace in the region and realized nobody really knows. Our elected officials didn't know much about it. And I've worked very closely with Invisible Children on advocacy and spreading the word. And they've done a fantastic job in mobilizing young people to advocate for this issue. And our goal with our film is to make sure more people know about the issue, because I do believe when people do know, they stand up and take action. And the Lord's Resistance Army Disarmament Northern Uganda Recovery Act of 2010 was really supported and put on the map by young people in this country. And that's also very exciting because they care and they're passionate.
And it was passed by a bipartisan Congress, which is unusual in these days. Go ahead.
Absolutely. More bipartisan co-sponsors than any other piece of legislation in 2010.
Wow. We see in the documentary the young people putting on their plays, and we watch the audience, and I'm sure you were watching the audience as well. What did you see?
I saw a lot of smiles. I saw a lot of laughter. I saw a lot of concentration watching and listening. And I was particularly inspired by the young people, the children that were in the audience. I think probably looking up to the youth that were performing and also taking in the message about HIV/AIDS. That was exciting to see them laughing and really listening.
Well, and interestingly, the young people that you worked with said that while the Lord's Resistance Army is a threat, HIV/AIDS is another threat, maybe even more devastating in terms of people dying of the disease.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly the perspective of several of our youth. They felt that, you know, Joseph Kony and the LRA is one big problem that needs to be taken care of. But let's not forget that once he's gone, HIV/AIDS is still here, and we need to take care of that too.
Fred, if I can go back to you, and even if you could describe what this part of Uganda looks like. We see some of it in Melissa's film, but describe this northern Uganda, if you would.
A main town is Gulu, and then there are some other further north areas, Kitgum, some other areas. But as you would drive along dirt roads, which are main roads, going into northern Uganda, there are large potholes in the road. Sometimes if there's rain, the road will wash out. So it may take to go 30 kilometers. It may take 3 or 4 hours at times. And you'd go into small sections where there'd be mud huts in small villages. There are also a number of internally displaced camps for people who are internally displaced, which are set up, and they've been there quite some time, and and you'll have alongside the roads people just walking, children, quite interesting, children who are 3, 4, 5, two, just walking along the road by themselves while cars are speeding by where there aren't potholes, speeding by at 80, 90, 110, 120 kilometers an hour, and the children are quite aware about getting off the road. No problem. And so you have this kind of environment, and you might stop in a village and go inside in the mud hut. And people, of course, everyone knows that a foreigner has come, a stranger has come.
Great
and you
curiosity.
Might sit outside in a meeting in plastic chairs outside a mud hut, and 3 or 4 chairs are gathered, and then a blanket on the ground for some people to sit as well. And that's where many meetings happen.
Well, again, going back to your film, Melissa, you go with your group and visit this this camp, and obviously a lot of interesting curiosity. And at the end, the little children are standing there, and they're saying, bye-bye, whites, bye-bye, whites, bye-bye, whites.
Yeah, we were definitely a main attraction. But the other thing, you know, you were asking how it looks. It's just beautiful, lush land, and these were farmers. Mm-hmm. And the cruel irony of these internally displaced persons camps, where they were forced to live originally for their own protection by the government, which they themselves became a danger to the lives of the people of northern Uganda. They couldn't farm in these camps. They're overcrowded. So you have people dying of malnutrition. Mm. People were dying at the height of the insurgency at a rate of 1,000 per week in these camps. And you have this beautiful land and these farmers, and they're starving to death. And that was striking to me.
We mentioned some of the girls, and we see a scene where one of the girls says to one of the crew, you know, ask if you're married, and he says no. And she looks at him like, he's crazy. Right? What's wrong with you? In fact, she says, I'll find someone for
you.
Yeah,
she says, what is wrong with you? You are all alike in this way. Because most of us were single when we went over there. And that was definitely an odd thing for them. And she did offer to find him a wife. He hasn't taken her up on it yet.
But, and you're going to be going back soon, do you think?
Yes, that's the plan. The plan is that right now we're raising some money to go back, and we really want to show the youth the film because we think they're going to be proud of their work and of what they've accomplished, and I'm just so excited to share it with them.
Well, Melissa Fitzgerald, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you
on
so
Radio
much.
Times. And the documentary is called Staging Hope. And as I said several times, it's going to screen today and tomorrow at the Ritz East. That's here in Philadelphia, part of the Philadelphia Film Festival. And she is an actress and an activist, co-founded an organization out in L.A. called Voices in Harmony. Fred Bemack, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And he's a professor in the College of Education and Human Development at George Mason University, founder of Counselors Without Borders. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us for today's edition of Radio Times.